What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
Welcome to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Got another action-packed episode today. Lots of legal stuff in the news, as always. We have Professor Alan Dershowitz coming on. We'll be talking about corruption in Illinois. We've got our regular Inside Out columnists, Tina Martini and David Sussler. In the legal grab bag, we'll be covering Hulk Hogan and some prominent sexual harassment lawsuits. But first off today, we're kicking off with the Merrick Garland Supreme Court nomination. We're very privileged in studio to have Andy DeVoot. He is with Loeb & Loeb. He handles complex business litigation, IP, and white-collar criminal matters. He is a former assistant U.S. attorney here in Illinois. And very importantly, he also served as a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist of the Supreme Court. Andy is our go-to guy on all things SCOTA. So welcome to WGN Plus.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So we all know that President Obama in the last week nominated Merrick Garland of the U.S. Of the D.C. Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court to fill the vacancy from Justice Scalia's death. There's been a lot of talk about whether the Republicans in the Senate will actually hold a vote about his nomination. How do you feel about whether the Constitution, first of all, permits the Republicans to not even have him up for a vote?
Well, you know, I think on that question, it's open to interpretation. I think as we've talked a little bit off air, I think ultimately it comes down to the Republicans are going to look at their polls and the Democrats are going to look at their polls and the Republicans are going to decide how much heat they can take in their respective states and with their base if they can hold this off and take their chances with what they hope is a Trump or some other individual as a Republican president. And I think that the president has put them in a difficult spot because he has nominated an exceptional candidate. And so it's now up to the Democrats, I think, to keep the pressure on and the spotlight on this issue because, you know, there's so many issues during a presidential news cycle, right? And then not to mention terrorism and all the issues going on in the world. It's just keeping the spotlight on this issue so that it keeps that political pressure on the Republicans.
Yeah, and, you know, Merrick Garland, just from his resume, he doesn't seem to either be on the left or the right. He seems pretty much a centrist judge, right?
That's right. I mean, Merrick Garland, when you look at his resume, you start with, you know, a kid from Chicago, which we all like the start to that story. But then, you know, he's a valedictorian at Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law School, magna cum laude. And not just that, his real world experience, you know, as a prosecutor, you know, he prosecuted the Timothy McVeigh case, the Oklahoma City bombing case. So you have an individual who is on the front line of domestic terrorism, you know, a really important issue in this country. And this is a guy who also has private practice experience. And with all respect to the current court, there are a lot of justices who spent more time in academia and on the bench than a guy who spent a lot of time in the real world, both in the business and the government service sector.
Let's break that down because that's really interesting. And again, your perspective as a former clerk who worked at the Supreme Court, President Obama nominated someone who it was a little surprising, I think, to me, because Merrick Garland, while unquestionably, you know, qualified as a jurist, you know, one of the most qualified nominees ever, I would argue, is white, is a male, is Jewish, is from Harvard, and is older. All criteria that you wouldn't expect traditionally from the next Obama nominee. You would expect someone who doesn't fit those criteria. The current Supreme Court makeup is overwhelmingly, you know, made up of people who went to those, you know, couple of Ivy League schools. You would expect maybe the president to nominate someone who is younger, not someone who's 63 like Merrick Garland, so that they could, you know, serve many years. And most significantly, you would expect someone maybe who is a little bit more liberal, someone who's not so centrist, so that, you know, President Obama could tip the scales in his favor. Obviously, he did this because this candidate, Merrick Garland, is centrist and otherwise would be obviously qualified to the Republicans. This could play out, though, that the Republicans could be shooting themselves in the foot, right? If they block, which apparently, according to Mitch McConnell, as recently as yesterday, if they block even a vote on Merrick Garland, then guess what? Who will Hillary Clinton nominate if she wins, or who will a President Trump nominate? Well, I mean, that's even a wild card.
Trump
who even
just
knows?
Said this morning that he's going to put out a list of his top candidates that he would nominate would he be president, which I'm just dying to see who makes the list of potential presidential Trump, but... Yeah, it'd be interesting to see that.
So, I mean, there's a couple of possibilities that, you know, they could block him entirely, or they could wait until after the election. And if Hillary is elected, then Mitch McConnell could suddenly say, oh, I changed my mind. Let's you know, have a quick up or down vote on Merrick Garland, right?
Right. And so there are a number of good points that you raised in your observations. The first, a lot of people are not particularly happy on what you would call the more liberal side of the Democratic Party. There are comments, you know, as you see in the media, that people, you know, that we think that he's entitled to a hearing, but he's not the progressive person that we wanted. It's not a person of color. It's not another woman on the court as the contingent of women has grown. So absolutely right. There's been that sort of feedback. I would say, and I didn't know this until looking around a little bit in anticipation of talking to you guys, it's my understanding, and I don't have any inside knowledge in terms of the White House, but that he had been a candidate before, both when Justice Kagan was nominated and Justice Sotomayor. And I do think that's an important point when people just unload and say, this guy was handpicked to make it difficult for the Republicans. I don't think that's fair. Did that play in the equation? Of course it did. Of course it did, given his real-world experience as a prosecutor. You know, Nina Totenberg has commented that he is more conservative on criminal law issues than Justice Scalia. You know, Justice Scalia was a known advocate of enforcing the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure issues. So he is a guy who has been in the discussion, to your point, about his qualifications. And there has been criticism more on the left than on the right of his qualifications.
Yeah, and, you know, he was also, too, when he was nominated previously, the Republicans, I mean, there were, I don't remember their name, but there were a couple of Republicans back in the 90s when he was nominated that said, if this guy was ever nominated for Supreme Court Justice, we would vote for him because
Orrin Hatch just, a few weeks ago said that he's obviously qualified. Orrin Hatch is like the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side. So
why don't the Republicans just put it to a vote then? I mean, if there's that many,
because it's politics. I think it's ridiculous.
But it's going to make them look a lot better if they at least vote it down and have a reason for it. But Mitch McConnell yesterday was saying we're not even going to put it to a vote.
And you hit the nail on the head. It's this calculation that I really think they've got their pollsters, right? Their best pollsters running, and they're on that fence. To your good point and that observation of, which is going to be better for us politically? Can we take the heat? Where do we stand with our base? And what's crazy about it is when you inject someone like Trump into this whole mix, they have to be thinking about that at the same time.
But we're seeing that crumbling already. I mean, there's been, seven or eight Republican senators who have already come out in the last two weeks and said that they will at least vote. Susan Collins is one.
Well, they're going to have
Mark
meetings.
Kirk of Illinois, who's going to be in a dogfight against Tammy Duckworth.
Yeah.
You know, blue state Republicans, ones who are going to be fighting for their political lives, are not going to just dogmatically follow Mitch McConnell.
And the initial step before the vote is they have to meet, right? And they go through a vetting process.
That's
those, not conservative, but the Republicans that are a little more to the left have already said, like you mentioned, they're open to it. They're going to meet this week with them to at least, you know, take the initial step.
Right. And you hit the nail on the head. It's the folks that are up for election or the people that feel that they're vulnerable. And what's so interesting about Merrick Garland, too, is just a little bit of that egghead Supreme Court clerk in me finds this interesting is that, to your point, I was just looking around at, when you hear about people and the judges that the justices draw their law clerks from, there's a term that's used, feeder judge, right? And in the Seventh Circuit, we're very privileged to have a Seventh Circuit that includes a lot of quote-unquote feeder judges. And what that means is judges that have consistently put, like there are only 34 to 36 law clerks a year of all the law grads. But there are a number of judges on the courts of appeals who consistently have their law clerks go on to serve for justices. And that's because the justices know that those judges have picked qualified candidates. Sometimes, you know, folks more on the left pick some from like Ninth Circuit clerks in California. But they generally know that these are people they trust are going to give them good law clerks they can rely on for this really important job. And so I guarantee without even looking it up that a number of Garland clerks have clerked for Justice Ginsburg, Justice Souter, Justice Breyer. But I went and looked just quickly, and to both of your points, Chief Justice Roberts has had three individuals clerk for him, the clerk for Justice Garland or for Judge Garland. And that's the ultimate compliment, right? When you're taking someone that you look to And because that clerk basically becomes a part of your family for a year and your legal family. And, you know, it really goes to the point of how he's trusted.
You mentioned your clerking experience, something that, you know, I think we're all fascinated with. Very few people on earth have done what you've done in terms of clerking for the Supreme Court. What's that first day like when you show up, first day at the Supreme Court as a young, eager clerk? Do you show up at like 6 a.m. before the thing opens? I mean, what's that like? What's that process like?
It's great. It's you're certainly awake at 6 in the morning, yeah, at home in your suit, sitting there like, well, I'm not supposed to be there for two more hours. I guess I'll have another cup of coffee. But it's great. You know, you just get there. And I think that I always try to remind myself, enjoy every day and that walk into that beautiful building and just to understand the opportunity you have. And every chamber's is different and the dynamic is set by the justice. But with the Chief Justice Rehnquist, it was just great because he's the boss. There's no question he's the boss. But he listened to you. He was interested in what you had to say. You know, he respected you. And he wanted you to be happy, both, you know, as a person and as a lawyer. And so I felt very fortunate. And I remember a couple times when it got really, really busy, you know, when you're working on opinions and drafts and things like that, you just take a walk around the building and remember how fortunate you are. Because at the end of the year, you're never going to be in that catbird seat, except for, you know, if a couple clerks go on to be justices themselves. So, yeah, it was really special.
Justice Rehnquist, stickler, I would imagine, for how many drafts would it take until Justice Rehnquist would sign off on your opinion on the opinion?
He was a stickler, but he was also notoriously a machine. And what I mean by that is, you know, he'd been doing it for so long. He could literally sit there and he had these law books behind his chair and he'd say, we'd be talking about a case and he'd say, there was a case in that term. And he'd point to a book argued by so-and-so. And it's relevant to this. He just had this crazy memory. But he had this rule for us. We had 10 days to turn around a draft from when we were first assigned. You know, if he chose to keep an opinion, being the justice with the most seniority, if he was in the majority, he could assign himself the opinion, which was great for us because you got great drafts or great opinions. And I think I told you before, every case for the Supreme Court is important. I'm supposed to say that, but they're dogs. They're cases nobody wants, right? That have to be resolved to give legal guidance, but nobody wants to write. And we were fortunate that we often didn't have to write those. But when he gave you the assignment, you had 10 days to turn around a draft. And there were a couple. One time I had to go to him with my hat in hand and say, you know, Chief, I need a couple extra days. He's just extremely efficient. You know, he knew what he wanted to say. He didn't think it was rocket science, and he wanted it done.
All right. Andy DeVote with Loeb & Loeb, a former Supreme Court justice. Thank you very much for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus.
Thanks for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Next on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, we're very pleased to have Professor Dick Simpson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Department of Political Science. Professor, thank you for joining us at Legal Face-Off.
Glad to do so.
Thanks for joining us today, Professor. So you've written a book entitled 2015, A Banner Year in Illinois Corruption. And it's kind of an easy state, huh, to pick apart the corruption.
So we wrote an earlier book, Corrupt Illinois, which covered the corruption in the state of Illinois since its beginning as a state until 2013. And we updated it. We wanted to see, did things get any better in 2015? And so we released a couple of weeks ago the report. And I guess the short answer is no, things have not improved. There were more than 100 cases of political corruption, either where people were convicted, where they were indicted, or where they were sentenced, or investigations begun last year, most of them in the metropolitan region.
And just
Chicago
so we're clear,
is the region is the worst are most corrupt in the nation, and the state is the third most corrupt state.
And just so we're clear, we're talking about for one calendar year, right, 12 months, your report found 27 convictions, 28 indictments, 11 investigations, and sentencing of 30 people relating to public and white-collar corruption in 1 year, right?
And a lot of them were major cases, like Barbara Bird Bennett or Congressman Dennis Hastert, who used to be Speaker of the House, and so forth.
And you said that Illinois ranks third in the nation?
Yes. And New York and California are larger states, so they have slightly more convictions in an average year. Louisiana and Washington, D.C. Have slightly more per capita, but by either measure, we're the third most corrupt state in the nation.
And Professor, I know this is a very, you know, big open-ended question, but why? Why is there so much corruption in Illinois, specifically Chicago?
Well, the short answer is because of machine politics, which has, over time, created a culture of corruption where citizens are willing to bribe public officials and public officials are looking for bribes. And there are various kinds of corruption. There's police corruption. There's various suburban corruption. There's corruption where they simply steal from the till. There's more fancy corruption, the largest of which is in corrupt contracts with, as they said in the 19th century, thievery written between the lines. And in contracts today, thievery is still written between the lines.
Professor, you served as an alderman here in the city of Chicago. You represented the 44th Ward from 1971 to 1979, so you're no stranger to city politics. How do you think Mayor Emanuel will – how do you think the Laquan McDonald case and some other recent situations will affect Emanuel's term? He's got many years left on his second term in office.
Yeah, he doesn't come up for reelection until 2019. His approval rating is the lowest approval rating of any mayor since Michael Bolandic, and Michael Bolandic then lost the next election to Jane Byrne. So if things stay as they are with public opinion, Emanuel would not be able to be reelected. Remember, he was in a runoff election with Chuy Garcia in 2015.
Professor, when you served as an alderman from 71 to 79, was there anyone convicted for corruption, any alderman specifically?
Yes, one of the most colorful cases was one in which I testified for the U.S. attorney. It was the conviction of Tom Keene. And in addition, Paul Wagoda from the 49th Ward was convicted. In all, since I was alderman, we've had 33 aldermen go to jail, and we've had a number of their staff members go to jail. We've only had about 200 aldermen since I served. There were 50 in the city council, but the turnover until recently was very slow. So that's an incredible crime rate. Remember, these are all federal convictions. They all happen through trial. That's a rate that surpasses the worst crime rate in the worst ghetto in Chicago.
You know, and you'd think that after all the news media has been, you know, talking about all these convictions with the aldermen, with politicians in general in Chicago, you'd think that they would catch on to it. And especially with the surveillance technology they have that they used with Blagojevich. But it just doesn't seem to stop, does it?
No, everyone thinks they're going to get away with it. And as I mentioned, there are a variety of different kinds of corruption schemes. The kind of corruption scheme that takes place with aldermen is usually a zoning or building change where the developer gives the alderman a bribe. Often that bribe is as low as $500 in the cases where aldermen have gone to jail. When you look at state convictions like Blagojevich, what you find is that he was getting illicit campaign contributions and kickbacks to his underlings for giving corrupt contracts, particularly in the pension area, which is one of the reasons we have such a high pension deficit.
Professor Simpson, you mentioned the brazenness that some of these elected officials continue to operate. We've covered the Barbara Bird Bennett case that you mentioned earlier extensively on this show. Have you ever seen someone act as overtly corrupt as she did, where she would write, where she wrote an email allegedly to these soups people saying that she needs money for her grandchildren's college fund and for casinos. I mean, how could you in this day and age be so stupid as to write those kind of things in an email?
I think emails are still beyond a lot of public officials. They think that they're going to be permanently private and that no one will ever see them. And therefore, they commit to writing things that they wouldn't normally do where someone might overhear them. So they've mistakenly thought that. We have a similar problem with election fraud. Up until now, we've not really been able to see people rig the elections as much as they did in the old days because of the computer technology, but it is now possible to get inside the black box and write software that would skew the election outcomes. We've been fortunate that hasn't happened in a big way yet, but it undoubtedly will in the near future.
Professor Dick Simpson, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Department of Political Science, also co-author along with Thomas Gradle of Corrupt Illinois, Patronage, Cronyism, and Criminality. Great read. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN+.
It's my great pleasure, and hopefully we will eventually rid ourselves of this corruption, but it's going to take more than a decade.
Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Next on Legal Faceoff on WGN Plus, we're very privileged to have one of our regular guests. He's been called the nation's most peripatetic civil liberties lawyer. He's certainly one of our legal heroes here on the show. Professor Alan M. Dershowitz, who is Professor of Law Emeritus for Harvard Law School. Professor, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on. Thank you.
We always cover a wide variety of topics with you, but we wanted to talk today about the People versus O.J. Simpson movie that is currently airing. We've covered it on this show, and you are featured prominently in that movie. Tell us about whether it is accurately depicting the story and your involvement specifically.
No, not at all. When I compare it, for example, to Reversal of Fortune, which was made about the Von Bulow case, which was absolutely accurate in almost every respect and really gave the audience an opportunity to assess on their own guilt or innocence, whether the case was fairly tried. This is just gossipy. I mean, it's all about Marcia Clark and her children and her boyfriends and all of that. It doesn't even begin to approach the complexity of the case. For example, it doesn't explain to the audience why we won the case. We won the case because the police tampered with a sock. They planted blood on a sock of O.J. Simpson, and they planted the blood of O.J. Simpson and one of his victims, and we proved it because the blood on the sock had EDTA, a chemical not found in the human body, but used in test tubes to prevent coagulation. Also, the sock had mirror images of the blood on all four sides. That couldn't conceivably happen if the sock were being worn when it was splattered with blood. It could only happen if you lay the sock flat and pour the blood on it. You don't see any of that. All you see is squabbling back and forth and yelling and screaming, and, you know, the lawyers aren't presented accurately. So, you know, it's soap opera.
You also think that someone has violated attorney-client privilege, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I can't imagine how the information got out, information I didn't even know about as one of the lawyers. But the show says that O.J. Simpson failed a lie detector test that was administered by Bob Kardashian and Bob Shapiro. And I know Bob Shapiro is an extraordinarily ethical and good lawyer. The only four people who knew were the two lawyers, O.J. Simpson, who certainly wouldn't say it, and the lie detector operator, who I can't imagine risking his profession by leaking it. But somebody disclosed lawyer-client privileged information, if it's accurate, and you know, it becomes a part of the TV presentation. They also have conversations, private conversations, between Simpson and his lawyer in prison. Nobody else watching or listening. How does that get onto the air? How does how do the writers know what Johnny Cochran and O.J. Simpson talked about? I don't even know that, and I was one of the lawyers. So, you know, you have to take it all with a very, very, very large grain of salt. A lot of the stuff's just made up.
The movie also suggests that you were brought in to the trial to shut you up, basically, because you were on Larry King questioning the innocence of O.J. Simpson. Is that what happened? Is that how you were brought into this case?
Not at all. I had been on the Today Show the morning after the show, and I said the evidence certainly pointed to his guilt. Usually you have to blame the – you have to first focus on the spouse. And also there was a history of abuse. And when Bob Shapiro called me, I said I couldn't take the case because I had said I thought he was guilty. And Bob said, well, everybody, basis of the evidence now, thinks he's guilty. But we need you because of your expertise in the death penalty, your expertise in science. The idea of trying to shut me up is ridiculous. And, of course, I only went on the Larry King show after I was retained in the case and did a lot of explaining on Larry King and on other shows about what was going on in the courtroom. O.J. Simpson wanted me on the case to be his, quote, God forbid lawyer in case he got convicted. He wanted me to be the appellate lawyer, and he was smart to bring in an appellate lawyer early in the case because an appellate lawyer is necessary to help frame the issues for appeal, and that was my essential job. And I spoke to Bob Shapiro after the show came on, and he said it was ridiculous. Of course, I was brought on for legal reasons, and the first thing I did was file a motion to take the case away from the grand jury and have a preliminary hearing. And that motion was granted, and that changed the whole case. And Bob Shapiro actually called me and said that, you know, I deserved credit for a lot of the victory because I had conceptualized and filed that motion. And having the preliminary hearing, of course, allowed us to lock in the police to their story. And it was a story that contained a lot of false information. So we were able to use that very effectively at the trial itself.
Professor Alan Dershowitz joining us on Legal Face-Off, author of Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. Excellent book, by the way. I've read all of your work, and that's one of my favorite ones. Take us behind the scenes of the Dream Team. I mean, this was one of the foremost collections of legal minds ever assembled. What was that like? What were the egos like, first of all?
It was a nightmare team, not a dream team. I mean, everybody was competing for attention. Fortunately, I was outside because I was mostly in Cambridge and just participating by fax and by phone. I only appeared in the court maybe a half a dozen occasions to argue points that were going to be raised on appeal. But there was too much tension between the lawyers. Johnny Cochran did a great job in herding the cats and keeping them all together. But it was not an easy job, and it was not a dream team. You know, Marsha Clark and Darden were two of the worst lawyers I ever encountered in any court, and they just made every possible mistake they could make. Using Furman as a witness was a terrible mistake. Trying the glove on in front of the jury, under California law, they could have required O.J. Simpson to try the glove on first outside the presence of the jury, but Darden was so inexperienced and so arrogant that he decided to do it right in front of the jury. And that resolved for us an important conflict because there was a dispute in the legal team as to whether he should take the stand or not. And this has all been written about. Once he was able to try the glove on front of the jury and say it's too small, basically it doesn't fit, then there was no question. He didn't have to testify because he had already testified without being subject to cross-examination. So it was about the dumbest decision I've ever seen a lawyer make in that case. And, you know, also putting on evidence that they should have known was tampered with just played into our hands. If they had just put on a simple case, I think they would have won.
Professor Alan Dershowitz, you've now been depicted on film on at least two occasions that I could think of, maybe more, but by two separate actors. In this movie, The People versus O.J. Simpson, an actor named Evan Handler, and, of course, in Reversal of Fortune, the late, great Ron Silver, who was an amazing actor, in my opinion. Who got it more right? Did Mr. Handler or Mr. Silver depict the great Alan Dershowitz better?
I was two different people. One was in the 1980s and the other was in the 1990s. They both got it right. They both did an exceptional job in portraying me physically. Handler came to meet with me in New York, and we went over some of my gestures and kinds of things. And Ron actually followed me around. He saw me in court. He saw videotapes. He watched me teach. Ron was not only an extraordinary actor, he was an extraordinary human being and political activist. And I actually spoke and gave him an award just before he died, tragically, at a very young age. But they both did a great job. And but I think Reversal of Fortune was a far, far, far better presentation of a complex legal issue than the FX story.
Professor, last question before we let you go on Legal Face-Off. You wrote a book called Abraham, the World's First but Certainly Not Last Jewish Lawyer, another great book. We just had Andy DeVote, a former clerk to Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, on to discuss Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland is also a Jewish lawyer. How do you feel about the entire process that's going on now, being one of the foremost Supreme Court experts in the country?
Garland is a great judge, very much right in the middle. I don't even know whether you can classify him as liberal or conservative on criminal justice issues, very conservative. I have no idea whether he's a Democrat or a Republican. It's the way judges should be. And I hope he gets confirmed. I hope he gets a hearing. That's the way the Constitution has set out the procedure. The president nominates, the Senate either votes up or down. It doesn't say the Senate can delay it. Or imagine if a president decided to delay it for a year or two because he liked the current Supreme Court and he liked the lineup. That would be a violation of the spirit, if not the letter of the Constitution. So I'm hoping that Merrick Garland gets confirmed. The fact that he has a Jewish heritage, nobody even knew that, shows how irrelevant it is now, whether you're Jewish or Catholic or Protestant or anything else. When Brandeis was nominated, the whole issue is, should a Jew be on the Supreme Court? In those days, there had never been a Jew. Now, if Garland is confirmed, there would be, I think, five Catholics and four Jews on the Supreme Court, no Protestants. And nobody seems to care because people should be picked for the merits of their position, not for their religious or ethnic affiliations.
Harvard Law School Professor of Law Emeritus Alan M. Dershowitz, prolific author, speaker, and all-around legal legend. Thank you so much for joining us on
my
Legal
pleasure.
Face.
I love your show. Thank you.
All right, next on WGN Plus Legal Face-Off, we are very privileged to have our regular guest from Chicago Lawyer Magazine's Inside Out column, Tina Martini and David Sussler. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're talking today about the latest article that you've written for Chicago Lawyer Magazine, available on chicagolawyermagazine.com, about the right answer for clients, right? Something we're all striving for.
Yeah.
Getting to the right answer.
Always.
Right? My first question is, how do you know what the right answer is? I mean, obviously it's something that each of us in the service profession is looking to give to our clients. What does the right answer mean, Tina?
The right answer means whatever is best for the client given the circumstances. I like to compare it to an optimization exercise where you look at a lot of different factors in figuring out what that is. Obviously, the legal answer, the correct legal answer, is important. You also need to look at the client's business. You need to look at who the decision makers are at the client, what their pressure points are. You have to take into consideration the timing within which you need to make a decision and get to the right answer. So the answer is that the right answer depends.
All right. David Sussler, you are Associate General Counsel at National Material LP with the inside counsel perspective. When you hire a counsel from the outside world, like Tina Martini or like myself, what are you looking for when you're asking your attorneys for an answer? How do you know what's right?
Well, I'm looking for an attorney who's able to do the optimization exercise that Tina just described. They need to know my business. They need to know the facts of the situation and help me arrive at the right answer, which, you know, as Tina said, is it's often the best answer possible given the circumstances, and they have to be nimble enough to get me there.
So when I'm working with my clients, it's important for me not only to give them the right answer, what I perceive as right, but also some background on how I got there, some budget on what it's going to take to get there, and also the chances of success. So do you agree, Tina, that not only the right answer is not only the substance of it, but some of the process and procedure as well?
Absolutely. And I usually like to give clients several options. Usually it's several options that are based on how aggressive the client wants to be given the circumstances, as well as how much the client is willing to spend. I mean, a great example is that I recently represented a client in some trademark litigation we filed on the East Coast, and they were in the right just on the merits of the litigation. But we decided that settling more quickly was the better answer for the client because they're in the middle of a transaction right now and needed to have that litigation wrapped up pretty quickly. But if I had talked to the client at any other time, they probably would have been maybe a little bit more aggressive than they wanted to be in this situation. So it's a budget issue. It's a timing issue. It's a risk issue. Sometimes clients are willing to take more risk than other times. And the budget is usually first and foremost what the client has in mind, especially if they're at certain inflection points.
In my practice as a plaintiff's personal injury attorney, a lot of what we do is partially therapy, too, to get to the right answer. Do you guys find as defense attorneys, there's a lot of listening to the client? It might not be legal related, but it might be more about their life, their experience, and what's going on in their daily life to help them get to the right answer?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of that. And listening is critical in understanding your client's concerns that often go beyond business, often go beyond in the personal injury context, which I used to do. It's not always the law that's involved, but it's their impact on their lives.
I agree with that. I would say that with clients, sometimes that's why it's so important to understand the people with whom you're dealing at the client as well as the business backdrop, because sometimes your job is to help your client contact reach the decision that is needed, knowing what the business backdrop is. And sometimes they're uncomfortable with what the right answer is, and you need to get them there.
And David, having worked both sides of it, is there a difference that you see with representing plaintiffs versus defendants? Well, I mean, now you're in-house, but on the insurance side or the plaintiff side, is there a big difference with the way clients react?
Yes. If you're from the personal injury world to the business world, there's a big difference. Because in the personal injury world, the plaintiff side, you're dealing with individuals who their lawsuit is probably their first and only touch point with the legal profession, and they have no idea what's going on. So they need a lot of hand-holding. On the defense side, if you're doing insurance defense litigation, you're representing companies who are professional clients, they have a better understanding of how to work with lawyers, how the process works. And that's the same when you're in-house or even doing what Tina does, I think, when you're representing professional businesses who are experienced with the legal world. The difference between the plaintiff and defendant side it is somewhat similar, yet follows those differences. And that is, you know, when you're the plaintiff in a business case, it's you know, you feel you've been wronged. The interesting part is when you are a defendant in a business case, you often feel you've been wronged simply by the fact you've been sued. So in that sense, there's a lot of similarities. So I kind of took you in a circle there. But
David and Tina, in addition to being partners in the Inside Out column in Chicago Lawyer Magazine, you are life partners. You're married. I'll ask you the traditional question that our host Sam would ask if he were here. But how do you determine who's right in your non-column life? And David, the answer I predict is going to be that Tina is always right. Yes? No?
She is always
Tina's
right.
Waiting with bated breath for your answer on
when
that.
When I am.
Yes. If your marriage is anything like mine, it's yes, honey, you're right. I'm wrong.
Just nod your head.
But I like to argue before I get to that point.
They are our Inside Out columnists. You can hear them regularly on Legal Faceoff on WGN Plus. Tina Martini is partner and chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group at DLA Piper. David Sussler is associate general counsel with National Material. Thank you very much. Check out their article at ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com. Thanks, Tina and David.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Did I get David's title right? Associate General Counsel? Okay, great.
Yes.
Thanks, David.
All right.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN+. We end off this show, like we do every Legal Face-Off, with the always popular, sometimes copied but never duplicated, legal grab bag. First story up today is the jury came back in the Hulk Hogan versus Gawker case.
Yeah, Hulk Hogan
brings joy to a plaintiff's attorney to see this kind of verdict, right?
Yeah, it does, especially on top of the Aaron Andrews verdict. Then we got Hulk Hogan with $115 million, which could potentially balloon. They're still doing the punitives. They have to come back for that, so it could balloon to even more. It might shut Gawker out of business. If everyone will recall, it was a sex tape that Hulk made with his friend's wife that Gawker leaked and led to the trial, the lawsuit by Hulk Hogan, and then the trial and the verdict, which, of course, I think was great to see, but it was based on, obviously, how defaming it was to Hulk and his image and everything that he holds dearly.
Let's say those words again slowly. How defaming a sex tape was to Hulk Hogan.
I don't think it was the sex tape. I think it was leaking the sex tape.
I mean, this is the guy who engaged in sex on camera with the wife of Bubba the Love Sponge, and he's now alleging that resulted in, you know, his loss of privacy and emotional distress. I mean, come on. Sir, yeah. You're Hulk Hogan. I mean, like, this is par for the course. I can't believe.
He had such a pristine image before
yeah,
this, though.
Exactly.
I mean, everyone loved him. Right. He was like yeah. America's sweetheart.
Right, right. So, and this is a guy who, by the way, I mean, he, in the last year or so, remember those tapes were leaked where he was using the N-word repeatedly and using all sorts of racial epithets? I mean, this is a guy that doesn't have a lot of privacy as it is. So I think the jury was just nuts. I think it's ridiculous to give the guy $115 million. Plus, like you said, he could get punitive damage on top of that.
Yeah, which is, yeah.
Next, we have the Norwegian mass murderer who is suing over his prison conditions. I mean, just when you thought that ridiculous lawsuits like the kind that Jason files every day couldn't get more crazy.
Rich calls ridiculous and frivolous, but they're necessary.
Yeah, things like this are necessary. We have the Anders Behring Breivik. He was in court last week. We might remember him as the extremist who is serving 21 years for the murder of 77 people in a bombing and shooting assault in 2011. He previously went to court because he was alleging that his prison term was in violation of the European Convention on Human Rights, which prohibits inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. And you know what he's claiming was inhuman? He said that his cell was too small, even though he has access to three cells, one for living, one for studying, and a third for exercise. He has a TV, a computer, a game console. He's able to make his own food and do his own laundry, but yet he's still saying that he's being deprived of civil rights. He threatened in 2014 to go on a hunger strike if 12 of his demands were not met. You know what one of the demands were?
What?
That he'd be given a PlayStation 3 to replace the PlayStation 2 that he had. I mean, when will this inhumane treatment stop?
I
mean,
I think this guy needs to talk to El Chapo and see what a Mexican prison's like.
Yeah, it really is inhumane to force him to use an old PlayStation, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, he should have up-to-date games and systems after killing 77 people.
So this idiot is asking for even more accommodations. I mean, it just shows that, you know, maybe the U.S. has it right when it comes to depriving people of, you know, depriving prisoners of some of these basic, ridiculous rights that this guy has.
Did you see any pictures online of the prison cell?
Yeah, it looks better than the apartment I had in law school. I mean,
yeah,
literally, my law school apartment in Northern Illinois was worse than this place this guy had. So.
Yeah, my first apartment in Rogers Park was, I would have preferred the prison in Norway.
Next, we've got big news breaking today and yesterday was that President Obama, of course, is the first president to set foot on U.S. soil in many years. In the run-up to that, Cuba lifted a lot of the travel restrictions for Americans to go to Cuba. Jason has a personal experience with this. I think you actually violated probably some of those laws before they were lifted.
We don't want to talk about that on air. But back in December 2014, Obama made the historic relationship with Cuba, and they're trying to repair it slowly. There's still obviously a big battle with Congress over lifting the embargo, which is the key component to all of this. But they are slowly working on the travel restrictions. And so I did go to Cuba in October, and it was on a peer-to-peer trip where you engage with other Cubans and talk to them about their culture, their life. So those are lifted. Now there's airlines that are competing now for the first flight, commercial flight into Cuba. There's a ferry system now that goes from Fort Lauderdale and Miami down to Cuba. So slowly but surely, they're getting there. They also allow more money to be deposited for Cubans from Americans that are living in U.S. soil. The banking restrictions are easing up, so it's getting a little bit easier to travel there. But Cuba's still a long way away from being a first-world country. They're still down there in the third world. They operate. Their infrastructure is pretty basic with powers, utilities, all that stuff. So, but they're getting there.
If I recall from the stories from your trip, it was purely educational, right? You were just exchanging
engaging with locals. You know, people down there, peer-to-peer trips, you know, talking to artists and politicians and, you know, trying to behave. We were branded as like an ambassador from the U.S., so, you know, just wanted to make sure we showed a good side.
Right, for sure. I'm sure
that's
you,
all that was
I'm
done
sure
down
you,
there.
I'm sure you did us all proud as Americans.
I kept a journal on it, too, so.
Couple of sexual harassment cases that have been in the news in the last week or so. One involving a very well-known celebrity chef, Michael Chiarello, out of San Francisco. For those of our listeners who watch Top Chef, as I do, he's been featured on a couple of Top Chef Masters. And Mr. Chiarello is accused of sexual harassment by former servers at his restaurant, Coqueta. I might not be pronouncing that right, but Jason is more of the foodie than I am. But Coqueta is in San Francisco. A pair of his ex-employees quit on March 12th, and they are suing him for a laundry list of lewd acts, belligerent behavior, and illegal workplace practices, including things like holding. They allege that this celebrity chef held a baguette to his crotch, stroked it in full view of his employees. He compared a sandwich on his menu to a woman's private parts. Again, this is what is alleged in this lawsuit. Again, he also allegedly said that martinis are like a woman's breasts. One is too few, three is too many. These are all allegations that we read in the complaint. Of course, Mr. Chiarello has come out vigorously through his attorneys and said that, quote, Mr. Chiarello is very upset by the allegations made by the two former employees. The allegations are not only upsetting to him, they are also against his core beliefs, and that he intends to vigorously defend himself. There's another sexual harassment case, again, out of California that in the news.
The dean of the Berkeley Law School resigned after a sexual harassment complaint was filed against him and Berkeley Law School. For his behavior didn't appear to be as bad as the chef's, but he was that really uncomfortable guy in the office that gave a lot of bear hugs and back scratches and back massages and kisses to the cheek, according to a former executive assistant to Chowdhury. So in the wake of the scandal, he's resigned. Berkeley obviously has a very large alumni association that a lot of them wrote letters and petitioned for him to resign in the wake of the scandal. So he wrote a nice letter that during these tough times with the lawsuit, he's going to resign in order to properly focus on defending himself.
Finally, in legal grab bag on WGN Plus, we turn to the Adam LaRoche story. Sam is our resident sports expert. He unfortunately is not here, as we know. So the Adam LaRoche story broke over the last week or so when it was revealed that he retired from the Chicago White Sox. He's a first baseman, a veteran player. He retired from the White Sox because he was told by Kenny Williams, who is the GM of the White Sox, to cut back on his son's time with the team. Adam LaRoche has a 14-year-old son. His name is Drake, I believe. And he spends all of his time both at home here at Comiskey Park and on the road traveling with the team. He does help out in the clubhouse, cleaning cleats, doing other things. And allegedly this was part of the agreement when LaRoche signed with the White Sox before last season. Part of the agreement was that this arrangement would happen, that his son would be able to hang around. Well, Kenny Williams, Jerry Reinsdorf, depending on which story you believe, was unhappy with that and told LaRoche to cut back, that even if he had his son in the clubhouse and on the road with the team 50% of the time, that would be too much. Kenny Williams came out last week and said, you know, in what workplace in America is it acceptable to bring your child to the office or to the workplace as much as LaRoche did? And this then, you know, spiraled into a war between the players, most of whom came out in favor of LaRoche against management. The legal question is, we're always trying to look at the legal issue here, is whether there has been a... number one, whether they broke a contract with LaRoche. I don't think this was in writing, but did they break an oral contract with him? LaRoche is alleging that because he did say that this was part of the understanding when he came to the team. And number two, whether there was any labor practices that were violated. The union has filed a grievance with Major League Players Union alleging a grievance. I think it's 11.
I thought you were going with a child labor agreement here.
Well, that could be too.
A 14-year-old in the clubhouse. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because Adam LaRoche did the same thing with his father when his father played baseball. And so he's got an interesting philosophy with his son where he thinks that his son can learn more in the clubhouse of a Major League Baseball team than at school. He's going to learn a lot of things. I don't know if they're going to be on par with an academic education, but I saw that there was a picture that was posted where he and his son share lockers right next to each other, which I don't know. I mean, a 14-year-old boy and a 25-member professional baseball team seems a little bit
inappropriate. It's ridiculous. But. I mean, it's ridiculous. A kid should be in school. Now, he's not. I guess he's been homeschooled for the last few years. But if he's, you know, homeschooled, do that.
Right.
I mean, it's nuts, I think, for this kid to be, you know, that intimately involved with a team. LaRoche calls him the team's 26th man. I guarantee you, you know, not every player on that team, even though they probably have remained anonymous, support this.
I mean, no, it's come out that, I mean, Chris Sale was the most outspoken one, you know, in support of Adam LaRoche. But, I mean, it's come out that there were some quiet whisperings behind the scenes to Reinsdorf and Kenny Williams about how, you know, they weren't happy with a 14-year-old being there. It's just like in court. I've never, I mean, maybe on like Easter break or, you know, spring break or Christmas break, you see one person that brings their kid in with them. But I can imagine what would happen at the Daily Center if every attorney had a, you know, 14-year-old child that they were bringing with. It'd be mayhem.
It's called take your daughter to work. Right. Take your daughter or son to work day.
Right.
Not every single day. So yeah. I think it's nuts. I think there's no legal basis for him to argue anything. I mean, even if he had that understanding going into it, listen, that circumstance obviously changed. So
well, yeah, and he's, I mean, they're all governed by their contract too. And I'm sure it was not in his contract to have his 14-year-old son there all the time.
Yeah. Well, as we know, I would hate to have, I can't imagine anyone on WGN bringing their kids or let alone several screaming kids.
Could you imagine someone stuffing four 12-year-old
right?
girls in the studio?
Imagine that.
Crazy.
That will take us to the end of today's Legal Faceoff. Thanks for joining us. And on behalf of Jason, Sam, we hope that you're still with us for the next show. Thanks very much.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.